6:05, I call the October 28th, 2025 Budget Subcommittee meeting to order. Steve Sherlock from Franklin Matters is recording. And today, kicking off the FY27 Franklin Public Schools budget cycle, and we're going to be doing a budget preview and planning. So, turn it over to Jana or Lucas. Please take us away.
All right, thank you. So, as you said, we've started the budget season. A lot of work has already happened within the Franklin Public Schools, and a tremendous amount of that is attributed to the work of Jana Malotti as a school business administrator and the work she's done. She will speak during this time we have. It's 6:05. We'll probably go until about 6:45, 6:50, so we have time to transition downstairs. So we've timed this presentation to fit within that and allow for questions as well. With that said, Jana has spent a tremendous amount of time building out the budget based on our newly reorganized district, and I'm going to kick it over to her. But ultimately, we hope by the end, you walk away as a subcommittee understanding our timeline, how we've structured, what are the drivers, and some of the other information that's critical to this particular budget season, and also any questions, because the last thing I'll say is our plan is to, once the elections are over, the first presentation we'll do to the entire school committee is a budget preview or overview, and it will include, this will be the basis of that presentation that would be built out, okay?
Okay.
Point of information, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Is it okay if we comment throughout, or do we want to just go all the way through and then comment at the end?
Maybe you could pause at different times where it's natural and then give stop for questions, and then that would, we can do that.
So whatever would be most comfortable, either way.
Yeah, whatever you prefer.
I mean, I can stop.
It does look like we have quite a few slides. So maybe just hold questions till the end?
Okay.
Just so we get through everything, thank you.
Okay, good evening everyone. Thank you for joining us tonight. Let's start just by revisiting FY26 as our baseline. Our final FY26 budget totaled $78.3 million, which represented a 1.08% increase over FY25, which is about $839,000. However, we started FY26 with a $2.1 million shortfall relative to the original level service request. If you remember, our original level service request was $2.9 million. And to address this, 12.1 FTE positions were eliminated along with cuts to our materials and supplies. It is worth mentioning that we achieved $3.1 million in cost savings through the district reorganization. And it's also important to note that these challenges were not one-time events. Rising costs continue to outpace revenue growth, and as we enter FY27, we are assuming a level service budget, essentially maintaining current programs and staffing. We are not looking to add. This timeline shows how we move from planning to an adopted FY27 budget. Budget workbooks and guidelines went out to principals and cost center administrators on October 6th. During that month, this month, we held individual budget meetings and requests are due this week. November and December, we'll focus on review and refinement with principals and administrators leading up to a preliminary presentation to the budget subcommittee and school committee on December 9th. The superintendent's recommended budget will be presented on January 27th, followed by the school committee public hearings and the school committee vote on February 10th and 24th, respectively. Then the process continues through the finance committee and town council in the spring, with the new fiscal year beginning July 1, 2026. This structured approach ensures transparency, collaboration, and alignment with district priorities. So we're going to walk through what the workbooks look like. Each school's workbook has six tabs. First tab is the instructions tab, and it provides detailed guidance on the other tabs. Second tab is the expenses tab, which includes historical data and current and the upcoming year's requests. The line-by-line tab captures detailed justifications for each request and links automatically to the expenses tab. The staff tab ensures all personnel are listed and accounted for, which is a critical step for salary accuracy. The new position request tab is being used sparingly this year as we are emphasizing budget neutrality. And finally, the enrollment and class size tab, which helps assess staffing needs based on projected student enrollment. This workbooks provide a transparent, data-driven foundation for building the FY27 budget. You want to take that
yeah,
one?
I will. Yep. So you'll see on the next page the budget priorities. There's five that we've put on there. It's on the screen as well if it's too small in writing on the page. So basically, we are living the newly organized district, right, and looking for opportunity in any way that we can. We knew that we would achieve some economy of scale through consolidation of 3 middle schools and 5 elementaries to 4, but now we're living it, and we're working very closely with the leadership, with the folks that are working within our buildings to really determine, as we landed, what's working, what's serving the students to the best of our ability, and what resources are working, and what resources could we look to refine. You'll notice too, just transparent budgeting. I know you just heard from Jana about the workbooks and some of the work that's been done in that area. Our goal is to really put out information as we continue through this process. This is the first of many presentations, but just continue to walk through how we arrived at the decisions we've arrived at for setting up schools. So giving the number of students in a grade level, that translates into a number of teachers teaching that grade, and when you divide that out, it falls within a recommended class range, just to create the logic between how we've organized our school so that it's not only set up for success, but defendable to anyone who has questions. The next, you'll see key investments. We look at our opportunities, the priorities that drive our improvement. One of the areas that we want to focus on is ensuring that we maintain appropriate class sizes. We know that that has a huge impact on the experience of our students in our classrooms. They are the closest they've ever been in parity in the time I've been in Franklin, because you have, particularly at the elementary level, across schools, you have 7 sections or 8 sections. So when you distribute students, as opposed to 2 sections of kindergarten in one school and 5 sections in another, just by sheer distribution. And that has certainly helped in that regard. I would say too, just looking at the supports for students, the complex students' needs that we have within the district, and how are we supporting them and providing targeted services that are appropriate and meet students where they are, whether it's through their educational, academic, or their social, emotional, or behavioral challenges, and how are we establishing a system that works to support that. Next, you'll see, obviously, investing in high quality curriculum has been an initiative that we've had throughout the years. We'll continue to do that. We want to put the best resources in front of kids that we're able to. And finally, just looking at our past investments and where can we find opportunities to leverage high quality learning experiences across the board for students. A few of those examples I just heard today. We initially had put in to have an elementary STEM, like a science specialized teacher. We had 2 on the books. We were only able to fund 1 because of those cuts. But I just heard today the work that person's doing to work among the schools and get in. A quote today from one of our directors from a teacher was, "I've never gone into the depth of science that this person who now has that lens was able to do in my class and work." And it was a compliment, I think we do a great job and our educators do, but having a resource like that was one example. The second example I'd give is the work that we did to put in a student services administrator. It has been split between 2 buildings, and frankly, there has clearly been a resounding a lot of support for that position. We have Katrin O'Rourke, who was divided between 2 schools. We're now targeting her in specific locations currently, but we originally had 2, 1 for each complex. We only have 1 now, so they're spread thin, but I think we're seeing value. I'm seeing some head nods from my team around those 2, just 2 examples, in addition to having class sizes within range, right? And a few other areas.
here's a snapshot of the main cost drivers we are seeing.
Maybe we pause right there because now we're getting into drivers. Is there any questions on just the priorities, the goals, some of the upfront before we get into the numbers?
Can you just tell me what that science position, you talked just a little bit, because I think it's something worth, like, the people keep asking, like, what have we lost? What are we losing? What are we missing out on? And I just want to understand it whilst I'm talking in the public.
Do you want to show a brief?
Sure. So you are familiar with math and literacy curriculum specialists at the elementary level. So this STE, Science, Technology, Engineering Specialist, is intended to mimic that role and really elevate our work around science, technology, and engineering, and specifically target, you know, preparing kids for 21st century skills, but also, as you all know, we've invested quite a bit in our middle schools around OpenSciEd and Project Lead the Way. And so these positions are intended to help support students at the elementary level and teachers where we know they're elementary teachers or general content teachers.
Right.
So the depth and level of expertise that any individual teacher has, which are wide, varied, and deep, but in one particular area, those specialists have over the years really helped to bolster teachers' professional learning and understanding of math trajectory and learning around literacy and foundational skills in literacy. So the intention there is to, in a way, in its own realm, mimic those roles to both support teachers in the classroom, giving students, there was STEM Week recently, and so she has done some incredible work. I just connected with her today on some of the exciting work she's doing, kind of project-based initiatives with students in these past few weeks has really been incredible. So those are like little pockets of things she's doing, but really the intention is to build the experience a student have related to science, technology, and engineering. And I would also say, and this isn't why we're doing it, but the MCAS for the STE MCAS has changed in grade 8 and grade 5. And so we're trying really to mimic the skills that are being assessed in a more, I don't want to say project-based way, but critical thinking avenues rather than, you know, the life cycle of a frog, but applying those skills in a science classroom. So.
Yeah, that's helpful, and especially for the younger kids, because like everybody wants to start with the learning as soon as possible in every area.
Correct.
So,
and I think as a result of having one of these positions rather than two, we are not necessarily supporting K-2 right now. This person's focused 3-5 because we had to kind of make some decisions of how to prioritize the time for that individual.
Thanks for that.
Yep.
Anything else?
From my end, and you don't have to answer tonight, but especially as we're presenting this to broader audiences, when we're making comments like key investments aligned with our improvement plan, enumerating those, or at least having something that we can say kind of quickly on a follow-up there, I think might be helpful. It's a broad statement. I understand that there are many, many things, but at least giving people an idea as to what we're talking about. Are we talking about a new classroom? Are we talking about technology? Like those kind of things, because I think it gives discrete targets for us. And as we ask for it going forward, it's going to be a little bit easier. And same kind of ideas when we talk about, you know, increased opportunities or investing in curriculum. Just if we can enumerate, curriculum's one that I've talked about on a few occasions where a true investment in curriculum saves us money over time, but there is an absolute upfront cost there. So being able to kind of show people, hey, these are what we have coming up. Let's put aside some now so that when we do get that big potential to save money, that we can invest at that point in time. So just kind of giving people some discrete examples, especially understanding what the new year might be like.
Okay. Thank you.
And one more thought. You used the word dependable, which I think is important because the schools get a bad rap sometimes on the street for really inaccurate information. I remember at the legislative forum, Becca Roche was talking about legislation around, like, or asking for support around, she was implementing like 250 kids per one counselor, like that. And Jeff Roy had said, I'm not doing any more mandates, like, that are unfunded, but like, that's a good bill. I can't, because I can't do that to schools anymore. Because I do hear, sometimes the council has in the past kind of recently referred to admins is always like a question, you know, like the, no, and so just having data around admins and counselors. Because if you talk to any teacher, they're like, we need more, you know, and we get feedback about like, you know, you hire too many counselors, and they're like, no, we don't. We don't have enough. So it's a thing that's in the public, and I know this budget season's going to get. We're going to have to be very dependable.
Yeah, we had a good slide on that last year.
Yeah, I think
and
we did.
We can do that again.
Yeah.
I think this is good info for us to prepare because we do intend. Before this goes to the school committee, we're going to want to have this. Will be a more a detailed version.
Yeah.
But having these pieces of feedback,
especially with the town council
to...
race, there's a lot of
like
public discourse out there that I
get. Sure. So just the ratios around some of those staffing decisions.
Yeah. Just kind of the appropriateness of
which we have. I just didn't enumerate them, but I think we can in future presentations.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Thank you.
That's it.
Anything else?
No. Please continue.
Okay. So. Here is a snapshot of the main cost drivers we are seeing as we move from FY26 to FY27. Transportation up 6.3%, reflecting contractual increases. Special education, it's up by 3%. It's tied to out-of-district tuition.
Mm-hmm.
Health insurance continues to be one of our largest pressures, increasing by an estimated 14%, which is about $800,000. And salaries, which make up the majority of our budget, are increasing by 2.5%, and plus steps where applicable. These, just reminding that these are mandated fixed costs, so we don't have a lot of flexibility here.
If I could add one thing, you may have noticed in either the projection I think the town administrator put out, if you look at the line of all the departments, it's a straight 2.5 down. Ours is 3.8. I don't know if you noticed that.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's highlighted. It's important to note that 3.8 is the combination of all of these
all
items.
All these, right.
So
yeah.
it's the 2.5% for salaries, but it also includes the special education, transportation, and our health insurance costs. So
right.
We will be breaking out health insurance from our ask, as just so there's that we learned last year that clearly having that defined will give a more accurate picture of what the asks are related to both items. So just wanted to put that out there to all of you as we build this out.
Can I say something?
So this is a description of budget drivers. When we build the initial FY27 proposal, we start by funding first all legal and mandated obligations such as special education, transportation, and professional development that's required. Next, we ensure the continuation of existing programs and staffing to meet class size and programmatic expectations. We'll also look for ways to shift costs internally through reorganization or resource reallocation. We also need to anticipate contractual obligations like collective bargaining agreements and changes in revenues such as state aid, grants, and circuit breaker reimbursements. Essentially, this is a balancing act between maintaining quality and managing fiscal limitations.
And we did settle the teacher contract this past year, but now we are entering into bargaining with the four other units. So we'll have the van drivers, the secretaries, the cafeteria workers, and the ESPs are all up for negotiation this year. We are in conversations with the FEA about that, but agreed that we needed to wait until we had our school committee defined so that we could determine who would be the liaisons from the committee to be serving on those particular negotiations. So I anticipate mid-November that we would get that information and then we can make some determinations. But those are variables as we enter this season.
Okay.
Any questions on those two pieces of information?
On the budget drivers, any questions?
I was just going to mention that at the FinCom meeting the other night, when it comes to the health insurance, because I know there's been like pressure on you guys, like, oh, we got to get the health insurance out of our operation budget. I've been clarifying that that's not what we're looking to do. We just want it on a different line item. We're not looking for anything else to get taken from the superintendent's oversight. We like, you know, having that, but educating the town council especially. You guys were in, you know, executive sessions last year that are now public that, you know, people were clearly not aware. People sitting on the town council for years were unaware that we carried that. So the narrative, what I was concerned about when I listened to the FinCom meeting was there's a gentleman running for town council, Max Morangiello, who stood up and pointed this out at the FinCom meeting, and the town administrator, almost in like a breath of frustration, was like, I'm happy to put it back onto the town. And I think that he knows that that's not what we're looking to do, and that really it's just we're looking to your point, to have more clarity around that when comparing to how other departments are growing.
I would just respond and say, one, we do need to make clarity no matter what the decision is, but we have been in conversations we have meetings pretty regularly,
yeah,
you know, with the town, and we did have a conversation around healthcare and where it lives, and those discussions. I think I watched the FinCom meeting,
yeah,
but I think what I heard the town administrator say is that we have discussed it as a topic of where should it live and how should it live, but I would
yeah.
agree. I think from my perspective, you know, having that regardless of where it lives, it's just
yeah.
having that separated to make sure that it's very clear to the community
right.
what part of the budget are we talking about. I think that's really, at the very least, what should happen. Do you know
yeah.
what I mean?
I just don't want you thinking that the pressure is to get it out of your oversight, because that's not what we're trying to do.
I understand.
So that's, I just want to make sure that
yeah.
that kind of got messaged, because it seemed a little bit like just everyone's anxious right now with, you know, the position the town's in.
And just 2 points for me. So on slide 6, we talked about this last year. We can probably collectively add up what that percent increase is for the overall budget, because I think that really hits it home. We're saying 14% is $800,000 instead saying, you know, 14%, 3.04%, and 6.3% are all locked in. That is this percentage of
yeah.
our budget.
Mm-hmm.
And then that would actually carry over somewhat to slide 7 when we talk about, you know, those top 2 points, legal mandates and maintaining existing levels.
Percentage.
That or just what's that cost?
Mm-hmm.
Because if we're going to ask for, just tossing out a round number, 80 million, and 20 million is legal mandates, 40 million is maintaining basic staffing. That's before we get into any kind of soft cost savings. That's before any kind of anticipated bargaining agreements or other changes in cost. People see just how quickly we come into, there's no flexibility.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We run right up to the edge on required costs. And then it's that little bit in between where we're trying our best to kind of pull things in and really make things more efficient. Not really a fair term, because I think we're far past that.
Yeah.
My point is, I think we are extremely efficient.
Yeah.
And at this point, you just start cutting things off and say, well, we don't need that anymore, therefore it's efficient. Doesn't mean that it's right. Doesn't mean that it's how we should operate. So just for those two things, I think helps bring people.
Okay.
And we have, I know, Jana, last year we did the total percentage.
Yeah.
And I think those are in other documents that will get pushed out later, but I think
yeah.
we would continue that.
They are in the master budget spreadsheet. So.
Awesome. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. One back. Tina? Thank you. So this is a list of some of our revolving funds, which we do rely on to supplement some programs. This includes receipts from athletics, lifelong learning, transportation, ECDC tuition, school lunch, technology, and others. These funds allow us to operate key programs without adding pressure to the general fund. Keep in mind their use is restricted to the program generating them. For example, ECD situation receipts can only be used to offset expenses at ECDC.
Thank you for emphasizing, because sometimes we do hear, if you collected it, can you take it? And it's important to note that it has to be spent on what it was collected for. So athletics for athletics. So that's
yeah.
good. I know this group knows it, but it's good to remind everyone.
Always good, yeah.
Okay.
In addition to revolving funds, we also rely on state and federal grants to support targeted programs. Examples include Title I, II, III, and IV, IDEA, and ECDC, and the Innovation Career Pathways grants. These grants help sustain key educational initiatives, but as always, are subject to state and federal allocation levels, which can vary year to year.
You'll notice new this year on the list is the innovation career pathways. And Tina, can you just give like a brief elevator description of what that is this year?
Sure. This has been a multi-year process, I think. We initially received the first phase of this grant, which allowed us to come together last year and build out what innovative career pathways would look like at our high school. So starting with business and healthcare and social assistance are the two pathways we're beginning with and have the designation through the Department of Education. This year, I have to thank Mr. Eric Stark, our director of STEM. He's done a tremendous amount of work along with the whole high school team, the head of guidance, the high school principal, the whole guidance department truly, and we hired a new guidance staff member, and we're working. We just received an award of $75,000, and that money will go towards funding curriculum connected to the innovative career pathways. Tandemly, we're working to reach out to various businesses, organizations, hospitals. I think everybody, I will say, is feeling a little bit of the external pressures within the healthcare industry and such, and we're, you know, working to kind of strengthen our relationships with a variety of folks in that industry, but you know, we're at the beginning phase of this, but really working to build the innovative career pathways out for students to let our middle school students know and understand what's available to them entering into Franklin High School, just as you know, they have other opportunities which they can pursue for high school, their high school trajectories. But really looking to build that out, and in the coming years can see us building up more career pathways. We just have to get kind of these two up and running. But hopefully students will know and understand what those are, and parents, and be able to come out with some credentialing or just some experiences of knowing what these industries could look like and whether they are appropriate or a good fit for that, you know, particular student. So
thank you.
Yep.
Any questions on funding through grants or through
revolving?
Okay. Questions?
I have one. Regarding the federal grants, have we received any indication if those are going to be discontinued?
We have not yet.
Okay.
Not yet.
Okay.
We have not heard. I think we've been on eggshells since this winter, spring, just when the first round, if you remember publicly, when the grants were, when it was referenced that they would be frozen, I think that was probably early spring, and we weren't sure. I know as a group, a cohort of school business administrators, assistant superintendents, superintendents, we were all in chats trying to figure out if we could get some information. We have heard that these have been frozen. I do not know what the future will hold. It's definitely a volatile time when it comes to federal austerity. It's actually a good segue into our next slide. But we do not know.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so that's a good segue if we move on. So external factors to be considered. I alluded to number three. I'll start there. Contract negotiations with our units. We're obviously looking to secure some fair and competitive contracts while being mindful of our fiscal constraints. I think that's our goal every year. We want a contract that's marketable so that employees are interested to join the Franklin Public Schools, but also need to live within what we're able to afford and within our limitations. I think that's the balance that Jana spoke about earlier around trying to make it all work. The first is federal and state funding constraints, and I think it speaks to what Mr. McNeil mentioned, which is just around the idea of grants, if they are limited or decreased or frozen or any combination of, would definitely have a huge impact. We anticipate tighter constraints to those title programs. That's just the word on the street. And it could limit our ability to fund initiatives and positions that we previously supported within the grants. So that's something that we're paying attention. What we would do if we do get word, we would definitely communicate with the budget subcommittee, but also the school committee in the form of an update. In one form or fashion, just to keep everyone apprised of like what's going on with that from that level. But we will see what that brings. The next is capital funding. We've relied on the capital request program that we've had in Franklin for many years, over 20 years, Steve, would you say?
No, since before I started.
Okay. So there's been a capital program in Franklin for many years, and we know it just becomes more, when funding becomes more and resources become limited, that's an area where we anticipate already, and I think it was mentioned by the town administrator in the FinCom meeting too, was just capital being an area where we'll see a limitation in there. I think what we will do is go through the process as a district, as a department within the town, to go through our process to determine what capital needs are, but just to prepare that it would be a limited year for capital funding because of the availability of resources. The next and final is the Chapter 70 funding formula. As you know, the state has begun the process of listening around this Chapter 70, and as we know in Franklin, the held harmless funding that we receive through the formula is something that if they do evaluate this formula and they make shifts and changes, this we run the risk and the potential of having that become an impact. And to, if that was a complete change overnight or in a year, it would be it would decimate the system. Right now, I think we have about 12 million. Mm-hmm.
For FY 26, it's a little more.
Okay.
Yeah.
So last year it was.
Yeah, last year was between 12 and 13. Yeah. Now it went up just because the minimal state aid went up from $30, what is the usual, to $150. So that kind of increased the gap.
Makes the gap bigger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this is under review. We are second to Boston in that chart, which you've all seen. There's listening sessions. We're going to make it known that a drastic change to this would really impact us. We need to stay connected to Boston. We need to make sure that if there are changes that end up coming, I think they would come in not immediately, but it would take time. This is a major formula. Mm.
Yeah.
And I only think there's one person that can explain it. I mean, he runs the Chapter 70 classes. You know,
Mark Abraham.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like he's the only person that could truly define it. But with that said, we will include information about this in future meetings. We'll continue to discuss it as a school committee and as part of our education of our budget. But that does bring with it some concern. It may not be a concern for landing the FY 27 budget because those decisions take time. But we just want to make sure that we're on record and have it on the radar for that being it. And I think without passing the overrides to get us closer to closing that gap, it just continues to exacerbate that issue. So as a district, it's hard for us to get up there when other folks are going to those hearings to say, Chapter 70 formula needs to be fixed. We're not getting enough. We're coming in from the opposite perspective and saying, hey, don't have anything major. So that's really the crux of it, if I'm being completely honest and transparent, that we're up against. So if you move to the next slide. Jana,
yeah.
You want to hit on that a little
yeah.
bit?
So just a quick overview of what hold harmless means in the context of Chapter 70 funding. So basically, hold harmless is designed to protect districts like Franklin from sudden drops in funding if enrollment goes down. It guarantees that we get at least the same funding as last year. So there is some stability built in. Here's how it works. The state makes a minimal aid adjustment. Even if our student numbers decline, we will still get at least the same amount as the previous year, plus a small per student increase. So for example, in FY 26, Franklin received a hold harmless aid. Normally the per student increase is $30 per pupil, but this year it was $150, like I mentioned before. So that's higher than usual, but we cannot assume that it will keep going up. So for planning purposes, we expect the typical $30 per pupil increase going forward. The bottom line is that hold harmless helps to stabilize our budget from year to year. But the trade-offs is that funding growth is limited even as our costs continue to rise. It kind of remains flat.
This is just the...
Yeah, this is Franklin's FY 26, Chapter 78. It kind of breaks down a little bit. So if you look, the first on the left, the state foundation budget for Franklin was about $68 million, representing what the state considers an adequate level of funding to meet educational standards. That figure is based on factors such as enrollment, inflation, and wage adjustments. Next is the required local contribution, which was $52.4 million, determined through the state's aggregate wealth model, which looks at property values, income, and municipal revenue growth. The remaining balance between them both, about $15.6 million, came from the state's Chapter 70 allocation. Since Franklin has been held harmless for years, we also received the excess base aid of about $14.9 million, meaning our total Chapter 70 is that 14.9 plus the 15.6, which is $30.46 million. Franklin is considered a minimal aid district, so we received the smallest allowable annual increase, which is usually that $30 per pupil. This year was $150. And this demonstrates the structural challenge we face because Chapter 70 remains flat while our costs for staffing, special education, mandated services continue to grow faster than the revenue we receive.
You'll see this again in different presentations.
Yes.
Okay.
And this slide, the timeline, summarizes where we are in the FY27 process. So we've already distributed the budget workbooks and guidelines. We met with principals, and we are in the process of collecting the requests. Tonight marks the official budget subcommittee overview. The next steps include ongoing review, refinement, and formal presentations through the winter and spring. Our goal here is to maintain open communication throughout, ensuring that when we reach the final vote, everyone understands how and why the budget was built this way. So this is it for our overview. I'm happy to answer any questions and hear some feedback from you as we move this process along.
All right, open up to Karen, raise your questions.
I'm doing that from my computer right here. So, this is more of a comment, but I just want you to validate. So as we discuss, if we could, in a perfect world, just kind of plan for like a 2.5% increase to our budget based on just like what we're allowed with the tax levy to increase. 30 million of that or so coming from the state doesn't go up 2.5% every year.
It
maybe goes up 1%.
1%.
That's pretty significant too. Like along with like that healthcare kind of discussion in our operating budget. That's significant. Because I know we had a problem last year where I was like, guys, we're overinflating in the joint budget subcommittee. I was like, we're overinflating revenue here. Talking about Chapter 70 going up. I think at the time it was like, on the five-year projection, like 5%,
yeah.
And then we got them to bring it down to like 2. But even 2 is historically aggressive.
High.
Yeah.
It's usually between 1.5 and 1.7.
So in this slide, where you say that the required net school spending for FY26 essentially is 82,899?
Yes.
So what is that as a percent increase from 78,309, what we ended up this year?
Oh, I have to do the math here.
That's what I was trying to do with my computer. I should bring a calculator to budget.
So 82,899 is what we have to spend as a school not to be able to meet the required net school spending. Our budget was 78,309 million. But we all know that the town also has some expenses,
mm-hmm.
A little over $20 million.
Oh, right. So that's
we do cover, yes.
Okay,
we do meet the net, yeah.
It's not our operating, yeah.
No.
So we meet net school spending, we just don't meet, some towns meet it higher than we do.
Yeah.
So I think we had a slide after this slide, because it came up the question,
yeah.
It was about showing kind of net school in context of other communities and how even if you exceed, everyone either meets or exceed, but
yeah,
then it's to what percentage are you meeting or exceeding across
right.
the state. I think that's a key piece of information we can
yeah, everyone's talking right now about the 40Bs, right? Because this, we need a certain amount of affordable housing in town, and everyone's like, well, we've met that threshold, why are we going above it? It's not the same with schools, like, you want to go above that, so. Okay. And then the only other question I had was, tracking concessions. Like, I know that we don't have, like, a formal system. I know this was brought up, like, back in, like, the 23 budget hearings, like, when we sort of had a higher number that we needed and we knew that we could get.
When you say concessions, do you mean?
Just things that we're wanting that, like,
the
other
science. I was taking that literally. I thought you meant concession stands.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I just, you know, like as much as it helped our town and helped our budget to close the schools and things, those are still concessions to, like, the community. Like, we don't have those little schools anymore. Like, things like that, it's important to track. So as the budget tightens up and we find out, like, federal grants aren't being sent over, like, maybe we could have a process. Because we've tried to do that in the past, and it's always like, oh, we lost, like, 0.2 this and that. It's very hard to, like, decipher to the public. So not really budget specific, but it is, like, airing our dirty laundry, so to speak, of, like, the things we're not able to offer, because it's that delicate dance of, like, you know, we're a very strong school system with what we're given.
If I could chime in, I think we've reorged now. I think it's a good opportunity to look at what budget we put forth that you approved last year, and then we have cuts in the summer, but we were planning to move in. I feel like it's more accurate to say, okay, we have a new slate, not a clean one, but we have a new slate based on, we've reorged, we put forth the budget that had all the positions that we thought we would need to be successful to open schools in 2025.
Yeah.
We have, like, those two examples I gave were, we have one of two, right? Because I do think, what I noticed, I think what loses its traction is when we discuss some of the reductions over time are actually mixed with enrollment decline.
Right.
So when I think what I struggle with is, I can think of a couple of times folks came to the microphone and shared during those budget hearings, and they said, when I started, we had X amount of teachers teaching this subject area.
Right.
And I can remember that I was working as a teacher at that time. But I know since then, a third of the number of students at the elementary level had decreased. So you would expect that when your organization declines in the number of students, you don't need as many sections of that to do that. So, but in addition, with budget difficulties, we also cut. So I think it gets muddy because some of it's enrollment shifts and some of it's actually budget related, where we wouldn't have reduced that at all if we didn't have to in the budget. So I think it's a good point. The only thing I do know is, like, if we're all living this now and we have a really tuned in community right now around this, what we do know is what you approved in the budget to move forward into this year.
Yes.
And then we know what didn't make the cut already. So to me, that's like might be a way that we look. It doesn't mean we forget about what we had in the past. I'm not suggesting that.
But
I do think what happens is, I think the community conversation starts to get lost in what we had and what we used to, you know what I mean? And I worry that, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't validate and have that, but it's a harder thing to nail down in a conversation with people in town who are in positions to vote on budgets and whatnot. It's about like the tangibles. Though that's just my two cents.
I agree. I think it's cleaner and
but I agree
easier
with you
to explain, and then very black and white. And then we have to just caution that as we prepare our budget for next year, it's going to be tough to do it in a way that's appropriate given what you know the restraints are.
Yeah.
And I know that there's a lot of community members out there also advocating that the town council sort of give insight and give direction to the town administrator for what the allocation should be, so we get it way ahead of time and we work with what we've got, and then we can start getting loud about what we're not going to be able to produce this year. So that's going to be a whole conversation of, like, how the budget might look going forward if people sort of adopt that. So which kind of stinks. Like, you don't, you know, we have a school committee for a reason and a superintendent with his, you know, own oversight for a reason, so that we don't have to build a budget, you know, scarcely. But it's you got a tough job.
Well, and I think to be clear too, there are things that were reduced over that time that we all know. So I wouldn't say it's all enrollment shifts. I think it's just a mix of.
Yeah.
And I think going back in time too far before my time, it's harder to
discern. Right, and those aren't necessarily what we want to bring back anyway. So
right.
I think you're right.
Right. So it's just, but it's a good point. Any other,
any other questions?
No, I'm good, thanks.
Just being mindful of time, we're about 10 minutes, so I apologize for any questions.
No, I'm all set, thanks.
I guess comments, observation, you know, that hold harmless, I think when I started it was around 11 million, and now we're up to 14.9. Yeah, definitely very concerning. Just get brought higher and higher and higher, and fall's going to be even bigger if we do get dropped there by the state. So just, it's a scary figure. I guess the only other question that I had, when you're talking about the budget drivers, you mentioned like reducing or shifting costs within like the current resources. Mm-hmm. I mean, we did, you know, the biggest shift of costs and resources that a school district could possibly do this year with redistricting. Committee's credit and so your credit, all the hard work you've done, you know, saving $3.1 million, it's certainly no small feat. You know, given that we just went through that, I mean, what capacity do we anticipate that we still have in that regard? I mean, I know it's still early in the school year, maybe we can find efficiencies as the year goes on, but I would think that well is kind of untapped for the most part.
We put forth an honest structure and system to support our schools with what we felt were the needs. We did that transparently and honestly. And if we didn't need to reduce in the summer, we would have had some of those positions that we did reduce. I'd love to have those back. But what we were cautious about doing, just knowing our fiscal reality of having two failed overrides, was the direction and instructions I gave every cost center, department leader, and school was around building a budget based on neutrality, saying, okay, you have this many FTE, staffing makes up 85% of our, you can tell
75 to 80.
All right. So of our budget, and I didn't want them to go into this with a cut mindset because we built it based on what we needed. Yeah. And I didn't want them going in with a cut it before we even asked anything.
Yeah.
But I also didn't want them to have a false perception. I didn't want them to go through putting the mental energy and work into a dream of like everything they thought they would need in this particular budget season, based on the context of 2 years of failed overrides, knowing the context. So I think it was more about just trying to say, how do we continue to move forward with the system we built, but recognizing maybe we do need to make some shifts. Maybe some of the return on investment on some of the positions that we thought we needed could be better served in another way, mm-hmm. and that's what I want them doing. So we will see what the future brings as far as that goes. But ultimately, the goal was to preserve class sizes and caseloads and try to move into this year, this future budget, building something that has them within the recommended ranges that we've set or you've provided guidance on, to just make sure that we're there. And I think that's the best we can do in this moment. But I don't want to shortchange our district, but I want to be realistic too. With, I didn't want one school to say, hey, I need like 8 more people, and so it just made sense to build it that way, and try to make sure that we continue to build public trust in the systems and the models we're building. So when we do ask for things that go above and beyond, it's clear on why we're doing it.
That makes sense. And yeah, as we've been doing as a district and as administration, as a, you know, school committee, we'll continue to do the best we can with what we have. And on that note, I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. All right. Time being 6:53, we are adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tintype Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. By the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.